You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
Although the Second City isn't doing in-person shows, classes, or events, we're doing all of those things virtually. Head over to secondcity.com and you can sign up for a class. We've got really affordable drop-in classes where you might be improvising with people from other countries. We're doing corporate workshops and events, and we have a whole new slate of virtual shows that you can get tickets to. Get more comedy in your life by going to secondcity.com. Welcome to the world of Tony Ho from CBC Podcasts. It's an award-winning, bite-sized narrative comedy series about human relationships, familiar, hilarious, and sometimes unnerving. The troupe features Miguel Rivas, Adam Niebergall, and alumnus of the Second City mainstage, Roger Bainbridge. They will take you on a darkly comedic ride that finds honesty in every situation. You can listen and subscribe to Tony Ho on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
My guest today is Joanne Lublin. She's the former management news editor for the Wall Street Journal. She was also a career advice columnist for nearly 30 years and shared the journal's 2003 Pulitzer Prize for stories about corporate scandals. She wrote the book, Earning It, Hard-Won Lessons from Trailblazing Women at the Top of the Business World. And she has a new book, which is called Power Moms, How Executive Mothers Navigate Work and Life. Enjoy the pod.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Joanne Lublin, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
In the opening paragraphs of your book, you write that, quote, despite progress in the decades since I decided to have children, American working mothers in the 21st century still struggle harder than working fathers to balance their work and family roles. It's not fair. And I want you to know that my wife vigorously agrees with you on this basic point.
That's great.
You look at two generations, right? And primarily in this book?
That's correct.
Tell us who you're focused on.
So what the book looks at is what has gotten better, what has changed for the younger generation of women who are getting into executive level positions in businesses and also having children. These are women in their 30s and early 40s. And how is that different from my generation, which is the baby boom generation? We were the first generation of women to get into high-level management roles in companies in America and also have children. And I was curious as to whether everything is now super cool and great and wonderful, or are there still unresolved issues that we as a society ought to be dealing with? So I interviewed 86 executive mothers from these two generations. The boomers, for the most part, were in their 60s. Mm-hmm. And the younger women range in age from early 30s to early 40s. But in addition, I talked to 25 adult daughters of the boomer moms to find out what was it like growing up as the daughter of a power mom.
And you were a bit of a power mom yourself, so that you weave that story throughout this book, which has a lot of rich evidence-based research in it as well.
I do.
These statistics kind of blew me away. Not that I didn't know them, but I didn't know them. So you note in the book that by the 1880s, 35.4% of married Black women participated in the workforce, which is a very high number for considering that time. Do you want to sort of expound a bit on this bind that is almost a double bind that faces African American women in this country with regard when it comes to work?
Well, I think African-American women, as all women of color do, face a triple bind, not just a double. Because there's a racial bind, and there is a gender bind, and then there is an economic bind in many cases for African-American women in particular. And so the figure that you didn't cite there was what a low percentage of white women were in the workforce in the late 1800s and early 1900s. And in fact, we did not see significant number of women who are Caucasian in the U.S. workforce until World War II. And so, you know, that is how, at least in many African-American families, the coping mechanism was to have cross-generational support systems in which the grandparents would essentially be enlisted to help with the children when the mothers were working.
And then even more recently, you note that as of 1988, only 2% of full-time women at U.S. companies with at least 100 staffers could receive any paid maternity leave. And for men, that figure is only 1%. And I mean, this strikes at the heart of the caregiving crisis that exists in this country. And this book just, I mean, points it out. And it's a really scary thing to come, too, because we've got, you know, this sort of gray tsunami coming that, you know, where are the caregivers?
Well, luckily, there is a much higher percentage of employers today that offer maternity leave. The proportion of employers that offer parental leave, irrespective of gender or even marital status, is still relatively low. It's also still relatively low for paternity leave. But, you know, the real crime, in my opinion, in this country is the fact that we're one of the few industrialized nations that does not have a national mandate for paid family leave, whatever the reason, not just for childbearing or child rearing.
And I think you point to some sort of cultural context here. I had actually never heard of the term workism, but I think it's an important term once I knew what it was. So talk to us about what that is.
Well, I actually had never heard the term either until I read about it. I think it was in Atlantic Monthly, Atlantic Magazine. We should give credit where credit is due. Uh-huh. And it's this love affair that we have with work. And I address it from a slightly different angle, which is this notion that thanks to technology, whether we want to or not, we can be always on. We can sleep with our cell phone turned on under the pillow or on the bedside table 24/7. You know, God forbid, you know, we should actually want to do something other than work. And that has, I think, been much, you know, to the detriment of working moms in particular, to try and serve that essentially insatiable beast while also trying to have a family life. I love the story in the book where this, again, this was a younger executive, a younger power mom, is on a business trip in Asia, and her cell phone, which of course she keeps on all night long because God forbid something should happen with the two kids who are home with dad, it rings and it's her doorman in her building in Manhattan saying, Mrs. Jones, your grocery delivery just arrived. Should I send it up? And she says yes and gives him the apartment number. Uh-huh. Said to her, you know, why did you do that? And she said, well, because I like to handle, you know, the online grocery order, and this was our, you know, grocery direct delivery, and it didn't bother me that it was 2 a.m.
Yeah, there's another term you introduced me to, which was telepressure, and this idea that because you have this device that you do check your work emails either on weekends or after hours, which is not always great for health, say.
I think it's terrible for good mental health to be always on, to essentially, you know, worship at the god of telepressure. But I also was very encouraged by the fact there are some companies that are recognizing that this is essentially a formula for burnout. And you have to set the tone at the top, and you have to establish a corporate culture that does not make telepressure or being always on the acceptable way to work.
Yeah, we had Adam Alter on the podcast. He's a NYU Stern School of Business professor. He wrote a brilliant book called Irresistible, which is about tech and its effect on our work. And there are some more progressive companies. And the story that always struck me from this book was a Daimler Chrysler in Europe. They have a division where when you went on vacation, if an email came into your work email, there was an incident response saying, hey, John is on vacation. He's not going to receive this email, so you can go to this other place. And he'll be back on this date if you want to be in touch with him. And that email never gets delivered to the person. So when you're on vacation, basically, you don't have you don't check your email because you're not getting any work email that's prohibited from coming to you. And I think these are the kinds of nudges that more enlightened companies need to adopt, especially as the sort of tech, you know, gets out of control with social.
I mean, there's an analogy for devices that we use. You know, when you use a heating pad, it shuts itself off after an hour.
Right. Right.
Your bed on fire by overheating overnight. And so essentially with the company directing that your email will not be visible to you when you're on vacation kind of forces you to be on vacation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
By saying, you know, we will not schedule Zoom calls between 2 and 4 p.m. on weekday afternoons because we know that's when all you parents who have been overseeing your children's schooling from home, that's when the school day officially ends and you want to have some quality time with your kids.
And I want you to tell the story because there's some proof to this, right? It's not just us talking. Leslie Perlow at Harvard proved that always on doesn't make for more productive employees when she was working with Boston Consulting Group. And you have that story in the book.
So this was a company which actually decided to put their money where their mouth is because they were having management consultants who were sleeping with their phones under their pillow. And so now this Harvard professor, as you mentioned, Leslie Perlow, essentially got various groups of management consultants to agree that each member of that group would have initially, you know, one night off a week in which they were essentially unreachable. Mm-hmm. And they had to do it, you know, again. It was a top-down driven process. It wasn't, you know, Kelly Leonard sort of putting his hand up over the parapet saying, hello, I'm drowning here in this telepressure, in this expectation of being always on. It was the company driving this, and it really improved productivity, improved retention. It improved everyone's mental health.
So taking the health thing a little bit further, because it's not just this, I'm not surprised by this, unfortunately, but you note in the book that, quote, several baby boomers I met never revealed their miscarriages to their mostly male coworkers because they wanted to be taken seriously and not detract from their executive persona. That is heartbreaking to me.
Well, of course it's heartbreaking, but on the other hand, being a boomer, that's kind of totally understandable.
Yeah.
You're one of the only woman in your level or the only woman in your department or the only woman at your professional rank in your company. And you're already suspect as being less than committed to your career because you already have a child. You're not going to share personal aspects of your life that would somehow denigrate from that work persona. And so that means you're not going to talk about your struggles to get pregnant. You're not going to talk about the miscarriage. And in fact, you're not even going to display photographs of your children anywhere that any coworker could see, because that would suggest that your children actually are important to you. God forbid, right?
Mm, God.
The younger moms were absolutely flabbergasted to hear these stories.
Yeah.
They could not believe that is what the reality was. But on the other hand, when I would hear stories about women who were trying to break the gender barrier at the college level from my mother's generation, I remember my mom had a friend, you know, who went to MIT when there were very few women at MIT. And she was in engineering, and there was no women's room in the engineering building. She had to go to another building to go to the bathroom.
Wow. We're recording this in February, and the podcast that dropped today is with two Stanford professors who have a book on the science behind humor and the power of humor for leaders and authentic storytellers. And a friend of mine, who's also a former guest on the podcast and an academic, sent me a study from Harvard that showed that when women tell jokes in presentations, it is not as well received as men. And we had a interesting back and forth. And I had this section from your book that was, again, shouldn't be surprising, but you say, many working women have never understood the necessity of avoiding various health risks because male-dominated science didn't bother to track their health. Medical research into serious lung and heart diseases included few women or omits tallying results by gender. I mean, this is hugely important and under-talked about, I think.
Well, it gets down to the whole issue of heart attack symptoms. From what I have read, when a woman is having a heart attack, it feels differently than when a man is having a heart attack. Mm-hmm. But we've always associated heart attacks with men.
Right.
And the irony is, I was covering the healthcare beat when I was pregnant for the first time with our son. And I was actually working on a whole story on that very issue, because this was the late 70s and women were becoming more important players in the workplace. And so I was writing a front page story for the journal on the extent to which, well, as the number of women in the workplace increase, will the job related health effects also increase? Will we be seeing more heart attacks among women?
Mm. All right. I want to switch to you open chapter 3 with a funny, not funny anecdote from 1986. It's your two working parents with young kids, and you get a call at basically 7 p.m. every weeknight. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. Well, the call at 7 p.m. every weeknight was from my recently deceased mom. My mom died last spring at the
five.
And my mother lived near us in the suburban Maryland, and she knew exactly what time it was that we would get home and how quickly we would try and get dinner on the table for our two little kids. And generally, the moment we had sat down to eat would be her nightly call. And she would say, "Oh, am I catching you at a bad time?" And I would say, "Yes. What's going on?" I was like, "Well, Mom, we've just started eating, just like we did last night when you called this time."
Because she wanted them eating at 6.
Well, I guess, you know, she harkened back to what time we ate when I was little, which was literally 5 minutes after Dad walked in the door at 5:30.
Oh, wow. Okay, even earlier. Well, and here's where you also introduce us to another term, and this is my favorite in the book, and I tell you, I used it in an earlier conversation today, which is this idea around work-life sway. So it's different than work-life balance, right?
It is not only different than work-life balance, it is the opposite of work-life balance. It is a phrase I had never heard of before I started reporting this book. I was educated and made aware of it by one of the younger power moms. And I was so enamored with this concept, I wanted it to be the subtitle of the book. And my publisher said, "No, you can't call the book Power Moms, The Secrets of Work-Life Sway, because no one will have the foggiest idea of what you are talking about." But the idea of work-life sway is that there is no such thing as work-life balance. It is like assuming an impossible yoga pose. You cannot have work-life balance, but you can acknowledge that there are going to be moments in your life when you have to be 110% there for your job. And there are other moments in your life where you have to be 110% there for your family. And they might also both happen in the same hour. And so the idea is you accept that as a given, that you're going to have to go with the flow, that you're going to have to sway back and forth between the various domains and dimensions of your life. And it's okay.
So the way this came up was just a couple hours ago. I was being interviewed for someone else's podcast, and they asked me at the end, they had these three standard questions, like we have our yes and question at the end. They have three questions, and one of them was, describe 2020 in one word. And I paused, I took a couple beats, and I said, sway. And he's like, why? And I said, two reasons. One was this. I had just read this and thought it was very powerful. And I just started listening to
the book, I hope.
From the book, yeah. I mentioned it. Of course I promote your book. I'm going to do that.
When you gave the answer in the podcast, did you say what?
Yes, I did. I know what I'm doing. Yes, you got another promo clip coming in 2 months when this thing launches. So I love that you like stopped the podcast. Did you mention the book? Yes. I said it was Power Moms. So the other reason is Kara Swisher has a new podcast with the New York Times called Sway. And when I play it, you know, it opens with this country song and say, when you walk into a room, do you have sway? And knowing, because I know Kara a little bit, I'm like, oh, I get what that is. Because you are walking in with a power move. But it's different, right? Because it's adapting to whatever's there. And I think it's like, oh, this is the word for now. I think like it, and you discovered it. And I mean, it's like, it's great.
Well, thank you for giving me credit, but I have to give the credit to Vanessa Hallett, who is the one who introduced me to it.
And I disagree with your publisher, by the way. I think it would have been an excellent subtitle.
Well, but in her case, she was at work when her firstborn son walked for the first time.
That's right.
And so her caregiver texted her the little video clip, and you know, she was able to stop work and watch it. And it was cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
Baby boomers, if our child walked for the first time while they were in the care of the care provider knew darn well she should not tell us that.
No, just lie to you. Oh, things were simpler back then when we just knew the etiquette of not saying anything at all. I thought it was interesting, too, in the section where this chapter where you talk about the controversy over mothers using of nannies. And an example from last year was the CEO who was a single mom and offered to pay, I think it was like $86,000 if the new hire could do thing like research vacation options and, you know, cook organic meals and other duties. And there was sort of like social media outrage about this. And if you really sort of like examine it, it's like, is that so unfair? Or is that so fair?
Well, what was unfair was that she was singled out because she was a mother.
Right.
And if this, you know, request for applicants had come from a working dad, nobody probably would have commented on it on social media. But I think there was also some economic envy there as part of the undercurrent. Number one, how much she was offering to pay this caregiver. And number two, the arrogance that she would want this person to, you know, arrange the ski vacations and make right. meals and, you know, sort of do the things that you associate with an upper class family. But frankly, if you're the CEO, you probably could afford more than $86,000 a year, because if you're the CEO, you're probably going to hire more than one nanny.
Well, you know, look, I hired a lot of people at Second City who became very famous, and you can probably guess that some of them have these. And then you referenced in the book, they're almost like the general managers of the family. And these are women who've become very successful in Hollywood and elsewhere, but they're running entire companies, and their husbands are working either with them or in another company. And they need that kind of help to be able to do the things they're going to do and get the kids to have quality experiences.
Right.
Yeah, this is not. Yeah. I want to touch a little bit more on caregiving. One of the reasons this is such an important area for myself is my wife and I developed a improvisation for caregivers program with our friend Ai-Jen Poo at Caring Across Generations. And this was teaching caregivers, many who are home caregivers, improv skills to navigate change and to, especially working with people who are going into dementia. And yes and is a wonderful tool to not block people, but to actually sort of move them forward. But you note a gender researcher, Francine Deutsch, I believe, who said, quote, there is no known society in which women do not do the majority of childcare. I mean, that's universal across all cultures. And then there's the myth of the egalitarian relationships. And I think that, again, talking to my wife about this, she was like, oh, yeah, what do you think about this? Because we were both working professionals
and raising our two kids. And she did the bulk of, I mean, it's not like I didn't do stuff, but I didn't do the school appointments and the doctor appointments. I didn't do any of that stuff.
And did you not do that because she didn't ask you to, or because it didn't occur to you to offer to do so? Because I think a lot of this extra burden that women bear as working moms is self-imposed. Guess what? You know, there are two adults in this particular household, and the other one is perfectly mentally, emotionally, and physically capable of taking on a greater burden. But if mom feels like either A, she has to do it, or B, she can do it better than he can, she won't ask. There's this great story in the book where one of the younger executive moms says, that's it, you know, I can't do it all. I can't bear all this mental load, this third shift. And her husband, who's an equally, you know, high powered, committed to his career, says, you're right. I will make the pediatrician appointments. I will take the kids to their well baby and well children checkups. And she says, that's great. And then he says, and what's the doctor's name again?
Yeah.
He has no idea.
Yeah. I'm going to try to honestly answer your question, which is, I think she was trying to ask me for the help, but didn't have the literacy, the language, because we did fight about this. I recall we don't fight a lot. There's like a couple of areas, and one of them was definitely the sort of balance. So example is, like, she's a really great cook. I do the cleaning. She does all the cooking. I do all the laundry. I always have in here. I take out the trash. I clean up around the house. She does the bills. You know, so we sort of settled into something, but then definitely, especially when the kids were little, there was much more that she had going on. And plus, and you bring this up in the book, you know, we were both executives at Second City, still are at the same time. My business trips always took priority. You know, I mean, and I know you're saying naughty. And when the kids were sick, she was usually home. And that might be perceived of because I had a senior position to her. But in fact, because of who she is and what she does, and she's a teacher, she needs to be in the room. I could probably have done that stuff by phone if I had to, but these were also days before we knew that we could actually work from home all the time. So anyway.
And there were baby boomers who I interviewed for the book who said, well, of course, when Johnny got sick at school, they would call me and I would leave my high paid, high powered law firm job and rush home to pick him up. And why wouldn't you ask your husband, the stockbroker, to do the same? And she said, well, because he wouldn't do it. And I would never think to ask him to.
Yeah. I mean, I'm telling on myself. I think I'm better now, but it's too late. The kids are grown. Okay. So in a moment, I'm going to ask you for a yes and story.
Kelly, they turned out all right, right?
Yeah. Yes. They turned out great. Before I ask you for your yes and story, you have a chapter called Better Mom, Better Boss. And you say, quote, motherhood transforms many women into better leaders. I absolutely 1,000% think this is true. And primarily because I think women are naturally empathetic. And I think motherhood makes that a superpower.
I totally agree. But I think we also, men and women alike, as parents, learn the importance of not only empathy, but also the importance of being good listeners.
Yeah.
Importance of patience, and, you know, the importance of being role models.
Yeah, yeah.
Translates into making you a better boss.
Yeah, one of the things I always say in my talks too is, I don't understand why when we walk through the doors of a business, we suddenly drop our humanity. Like, we think somehow these things aren't connected. And it's like, no. The stuff that makes you actually a good human being is the stuff that makes you a good person at business.
It's like you don't stop being a parent when you walk in the door of a workplace, and you don't stop being a worker when you walk in the door of a home.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've had to sort of wear both those hats 24/7 for the last 11 months.
Okay. So we always ask our guests for a yes and story. So in the parlance of improvisation, when groups of people are making something out of nothing, they get nowhere by saying no. They actually don't get that far by saying yes. You say yes and, you affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. Do you have a yes and story for us?
Well, my story is actually a story in which I initially said no. And then I said, yes, and.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happened was I was working a four-day schedule for the journal when I got promoted into management, moved to London, went back to a five-day-a-week schedule. And then when I was on the precipice of returning to New York for the journal, I was visiting with the managing editor, a guy named Norm Perlstein, who knew I was going to be commuting a long way each day from suburban New Jersey to our offices in New York, and said to me, do you want to work from home on Fridays? And I was like, no. You know, I've been in the office 5 days a week in London for the last almost 4 years, and my kids are school age. I don't need that. And then he had to take a phone call and walk out of the office. And while he's out of the office, I'm sitting there thinking, you idiot. And so when he walks back in, I said, yes. And I would very much appreciate having that option to work from home on Fridays. And I did it for the next 20 years until my last day as a full-time employee, which happened to be a Friday. So I went in the office.
Oh, that's great. I love that story. The book is called Power Moms, How Executive Mothers Navigate Work and Life. Joanne Lublin, thank you for coming on the show.
You're welcome, Kelly. And don't forget to keep folding the laundry the right way or else she'll get mad at you.
She's not going to get mad. She's just happy I'm doing it.
Getting the SAN is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is LF Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumblebear, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fade. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Survive.